sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Venezuela devalues their currency by 33%. Apple's moving markets again. We have a permabear with us today, self-proclaimed Tim Knight, who is with theslopeofhope.com. He writes for them and lots more. All this and much more on episode 300 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hey there, Andrew Horowitz here, and we're going to have a great show today because not only do we have a great guest who I haven't talked to in a long time, keep in touch with him, but haven't had him on the podcast, but also some very cool things happening in the markets right now that need to be discussed because just more moving parts, more things that are happening. You know, we talked about the currency wars that are beginning to show just how much of a protectionism style of thought process is happening with many of the governments around the world. And last week, clearly, it was all about currency moves that had a lot of people on edge and some concerns that were in the market that actually had the Dow Jones Industrials down for the first time in many weeks. The S&P and the NASDAQ managed to have a gain, but that was really only because of a couple of reasons that were kind of shoved into the market and really related to Apple. So we're going to talk about that. Also want to mention to you, very important, very cool, is that starting on Monday, we have a brand new commodity alert. The Trigger Point Research commodity alerts, which have been really gaining some traction. The portfolio, if you were to track it against a $25,000 portfolio, you would see that it's up about 20% since we started in November, mid-November. And that's pretty good. Not that many trades actually happen with that. We also have a different system that's coming out on an auto trade. But nonetheless, what's really neat about that is that we have a brand new site that will track it starting Monday. And we also have the ability to, one, get, as you have before, text messages and emails directly. And you also now have the ability to auto-trade your account. If you link a brokerage account to this, it will automatically trade. Now, what's great about that is we've had a lot of people around the world write to us and say, hey, you know what? This is great, but I don't know if I can implement because I'm in Australia and because of the time zones and all that, I may not get the alert and the update in the time that it is, you know, required to do. And so what we did is we found a solution. So what I want you to do is you can go to the show notes of this particular podcast, episode number 300, and we will put all the information on how to check that out, which is really nice. You can also watch the trades as they happen. Actually, if you're not a subscriber, you'll see the closed trades as they occur. And that's going to happen and is totally, monitored by autotradenow.com. So really interesting things that are happening. If you haven't traded commodities, we're in a variety of different markets. We deal with corn and wheat and gold, natural gas, oil, NASDAQ, the S&P futures, treasuries. So you want to check that out. I think you really would like to at least have that on your bookmark where you can watch that. Let's talk about what to get to first. Let's talk about Venezuela. I think that's important because on Friday, I noticed that one of the stocks that we had held, a very small position, Mercado Libre, was also starting to kind of get a little soft. And I said, what's going on there? Well, I kind of looked around and I noticed a couple of news items that didn't seem really important. And then I saw that Venezuela has devalued their currency by about 33%. Now, this would obviously have an effect on any of the companies that do a lot of business in that area. It also has an effect on companies that are in the peripheral that get some business from customers and people in Venezuela. Now, this is not the first time, the second time, or the third time, or keep going. But Venezuela keeps on devaluing their currency. They have a real inflation problem there. But basically, the reason that they did it was because now they can get a lot more of their local currency for selling oil. Now, this does not help their imports, obviously. You know, a 30-something percent devaluation overnight is not great. Inflation is going to, you know, continue to be a problem. They have a lot of problem getting goods. Many of the consumer goods are just gone. And they can't just, you know, people can't afford it. Now their currency has dropped by, you know, another 30% here. And how are they going to buy things? But the government is going to continue to make plenty of money because now they have a lot of money coming in, you know, a multiple of the amount they had prior from their oil sales. And if they distribute to the people in their country and the citizens, hey, great, but, you know, we know what goes on down there. It's not quite that simple. So that had hurt a variety of the consumer good companies. If you watch the stock charts in the probably in the afternoon hours of Friday, you'll notice that there was a couple of blips there with Procter & Gamble and any of these staple companies that would do have international exposure and do a lot of business or at least some part of their business in Venezuela, because now obviously their products are much more expensive and they're going to have to do a couple things. Either they're going to not sell anything because they just can't be afforded, or what they're going to have to do is lower their pricing structure. Either way, that's not a good thing for that component of their income. So, you know, this is in reaction to all the things that have been going on around the world. Just one more currency transaction. We also had, in the middle of the week, we had the ECB come out and say that, hey, they're a little bit more hawkish. They're looking at the inflation situation. They're not going to drop the rates, which are now at 0.75 as compared to 0 to 0.25 here. And at the same time, you know, they're going to be on alert to look for if there's any inflationary pressures. They also said that, hey, you know what? At the same time, we do not see a lot of growth coming back to the region. Well, that took the euro from about 137 to where it finished right at about 134 throughout the week, down from about, 3 days of losses on the euro. And that really pushed the dollar up pretty well, over 80. And the yen continues to lose ground, although Friday it was down about close to 1%. Now, that's just the start of it. We're starting to see little murmurs around the world about this currency issue, especially because Japan now has said, and I'll quote, I have a great article here. This is unbelievable. This is over the weekend, that Japan's Amari wants the Nikkei to reach 13,000. That's about about a 20%, 15%, 18% rise from where we are now at about 11,100 by, get this, March. The Japanese government will continue its efforts, he's saying, to drive the Nikkei 225 stock average to 13,000 points by the end of the fiscal year on March, this is by an economic minister, Akari Amari. And he was speaking to support, now, of course, he was speaking to supporters in his electoral district of Kanagawa. I probably butchered that pretty well. Anyway, here's what's interesting. Obviously, they've said also last week that, hey, you know what? It is not us that is pressuring the yen. It is the market. The market is just reacting to the moves that we're making on a fiscal basis. Really? Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you mean the effervescence of your discussions constantly talking down the yen and saying how that you're going to put pressure on it and there is no end in sight to what you will do to drive the yen down isn't doing anything? No, I don't think so. How are you going to drive the yen down? Well, we know how you're going to do that. You're going to monetize your debt continually as you've been doing it. So you have to take some of the discussion from these various ministers or central bankers with a real gigantic, not a grain of salt, but more like a rock of salt. Because, you know, what they're trying to do is create an export environment that is much better. As a matter of fact, we saw that, for example, Toyota raised their guidance significantly because of the currency. I mean, you see a 15% change in their currency on the downside. Well, they can make a lot more money, and it makes their products that much more affordable. So there is a lot of moving parts in this market, not only earnings, not only economics, but now we have currency that's really starting to kick up pretty significantly. Question is, for all of you that are thinking this, by continuing to devalue the currency, does that in fact make a worldwide devaluation, or does it put everything back on the same plane? Why isn't gold really moving up at this point? Why, you know, what's happening? Sure, oil is, you know, at the 96 level, clearly overpriced from a fundamental basis. Gasoline is the highest price it has been for this time of year on record. So there's a lot of competing issues going on right here, but I'll tell you a couple of things. Number one, clearly devaluing a currency or, you know, making a currency weaker, it does help their exports, no question. As a matter of fact, there's, it's a simple calculation. On the other hand, it is not in the best interest of a country to do that for a prolonged period. Because what it does do, inevitably, is to create inflationary pressures, unmistakably. Even though we have no inflation in this country, I've said this before, I don't know about you, I am paying more for every single thing that I buy. Just going to a restaurant, the prices are absurd. I went bowling yesterday. My son said, let's go bowling. I said, okay, let's go. It was $30 for two people, just for bowling, for 2 hours. And you may say, well, it's what, $7.50 an hour, one person. But you know what? That's a lot of money in comparison to what it was just 10 years ago. Forget about 20 years ago. Going to a Broadway show, unbelievable. Filling your car up with gas, insurance, cost of food. It's just gone up and up. Cost of college, education. I don't know of anything that I could think of that has gone down in price. So what we are seeing is a kind of a hidden inflationary bump across the board, which is, by the way, where you have the increase, however slight increase in earnings, because you're paying more for products. Companies have done a great job at slimming down their expense ratio because revenues are coming in not as great as they should be. They're flatlining to down. Outlook has been down. So another week of earnings come out last week. Winners and losers all over the place. But at the same time, even though analysts have been bringing down estimates dramatically, they're beating slightly. But at the same time, their revenues and their outlook is very poor. So let's get into this discussion of kind of Apple, what happened there. So on Thursday, there was a big discussion on CNBC with David Einhorn, a well-known hedge fund manager who said, hey, you know what? Apple's our biggest position that we've ever had in our portfolio. It's the biggest we've ever had now. And here's what we propose. We think that Apple should give back. Okay. Apple should give back in the form of a dividend. They have $140 billion of cash on the books. And you know what? We're going to get proactive here. We're going to become an activist investor because we have such a large position and we want Apple to go ahead and issue a preferred stock with an 8% dividend, give back, blah, 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 blah. The stock moved up initially, came back down, kind of flatlined for a while. Well, at the end of the day, about 3:30 on Thursday, Apple came out with a statement that was kind of, I don't know, it was there was nothing on either side, but they did say that they would consider all alternatives, especially, you know, the Einhorn, they addressed that, all alternatives to benefiting shareholders, and, you know, they would consider all options. Well, the stock ramped by about 3% in about 20 minutes or so, and that, of course, took the NASDAQ up dramatically, the NASDAQ 100 up about 60 basis points just right on that because you know, it's about a 20% position there. Took the S&P 500 up as well. Dow Jones, of course, you know, there was a little bit of movement there, but not as much of a dramatic move because it's not part of it. Now, will Apple or, you know, will they do this? Well, Apple doesn't seem like they want to really do this. And Einhorn is kind of petitioning to separate these proxies and take out the discussion of the potential of return of shareholders and how that would work and how the voting works and take that separate so that, you know, shareholders can vote on that. Already we're seeing over the weekend, several major institutions are siding with Apple. I haven't seen many actually other than Einhorn and a few others that, you know, want to have a better dividend that said, you know, hey, you know what? It's okay. We want to go with Einhorn. Everybody seems to be siding with Apple, and Apple seems to be wanting to kind of keep their dividend intact as it is, maybe a little bit of a bump, possibly, but they want to keep a very big cash on hand, or at least cash on hand for alternative investments rather than simply giving it back to shareholders. So I think there's going to be a lot of play in this. There is, at this point, I guess there is until the vote happens, there is a put underlying Apple shares because if there is a significant dividend, you open it up to a lot more players, a lot more potential investors. You're going to have investors that are going to be betting on there will be this opportunity and moving in at this point. We'll see what happens. Because the fundamentals of Apple otherwise haven't changed right now. So really what we're talking about is just the opportunity to be playing this on the volatility that will happen between now and the time that the vote actually happens by shareholders to either allow for this this change or at least allow for Apple to consider this or not. I would see that I'd like to see a lot more institutions come out and give us a little bit of an indication of which side they're, you know, kind of on. But right now, it looks like a lot are definitely siding with Apple. We'll have to see what happens with that. But that's going to rock the NASDAQ, you know, either way on all this news. In the meantime, you know, you're finding out that, again, the earnings have been a bit lukewarm. Now, next week, we have some earnings that are kind of important that I'm going to be looking at. Fossil's coming out next week. We have a short position in Coors. Now, Coors, Michael Coors. And, you know, we find the stock to be rather overvalued, which may or not be the case. Kind of is moving within a range right now. A lot of analysts coming out with recent buy targets on it, you know, and upgrades. And we'll see really as a read-through what happens with Fossil. Fossil has been very volatile. We'll see if the consumers are still buying watches as they are because Coors and Fossil, you know, trade kind of very similarly. There were some other things that are happening as well throughout the week. We have a post that's going up, an article going up, I think, Monday morning. You'll see all the 53 components of the S&P 500 that are actually reporting next week that you really want to key on. And what we did is we put a little bit of a cheat sheet for you. So you have, for example, the analyst estimates, the revenue estimates for EPS and for revenue. And you also have how much the analysts have changed their overall earnings outlook over the last 4 weeks. Now, when it comes to economics next week, we have a couple things that are really interesting. I think the biggest issue that we saw from last week was that the inventory build was very light. As a matter of fact, it was negative, which goes along with the whole discussion that manufacturers have slowed down because they have seen that inventories have risen and sales have not picked up. Next week, we'll get the read on retail sales in the middle of the week. I think Wednesday it is. And then on Friday, we'll see the preliminary February numbers for the Michigan sentiment, which was revised a little bit higher. But we'll see how that has either recovered or stagnated in January after all that hubbub with the fiscal cliff and all those things that, you know, happened. Big issues that I think are really going to be focusing on the consumer right now because, of course, we know that the consumer is paying a lot more for gasoline and has a lot less in their pocketbook because of the payroll tax holiday that went away. And then, of course, at the end of the month, we have to kind of consider the whole idea that we're going to go through another, I don't know, battle or discussion or, you know, compromise with this whole sequestration and this whole military cutting of the defense budget and all the extra costs that were going to be involved and cuts that were going to be involved and taxation, et cetera, et cetera. So lots happening there. Now, China, I have to talk about this. This is kind of cool. China is now the largest, surpassing the U.S. to become the world's biggest trading nation in 2012. They're still not at the size that we are in terms of GDP and total you know, export, import, but they are, I think when you look at that, I think, let's see what it says here. The imports last year totaled $3.8 trillion, and that was higher than expected. And they had a $231 billion trade surplus, although the U.S. has a trade deficit of $729 billion. But yeah, they're the biggest trading partner of the world, or the trading nation of the world. And that's pretty impressive overall, and that gives them a much bigger potential seat when it comes to possibly looking at the global landscape. So they were the largest exporter back in 2009, if you remember. U.S. remains the largest importer. But that's pretty impressive that they overall are the largest trading country in the world, I think at least. So, you know, we'll see what happens there. We're going to get to our guest in a second. I want to mention, of course, GoToPC. This is something that you really want to check out. Go to MyPC. That's it. GoToMyPC.com is really a great service because, if you know, it's kind of like if you forget your keys or your phone when you're out, you're kind of screwed. Well, if you forget to get something from your computer, what do you do? Well, GoToMyPC has a solution for that. You don't have to worry about getting dressed and driving back to the office and dealing with things or, you know, something if you're in the office, getting something from home, you don't have to carry around those disk or a drive or anything like that. So what you could do very simply is get a free trial of this 30 days unlimited, which is really great. All you have to do is go to mypc.com, click the try it free button, and enter the promo code podcast. Then you download the app, whether it's a mobile one or the one for your computer, and that's it. Free, 30 days. Go to mypc.com, a great service from Citrix. Love them. All right, so I mentioned, of course, the TPR commodity alerts, which I want to make sure and ingrain this in you. I want you to go check it out because you can track it. And instead of going through the whole process of getting a trial, which we've discontinued, it's $99 per month. Very inexpensive. That's based on we think about a $25,000 trading account in concept and a portfolio. We also have the equity alerts, of course, which we do have the trials for. You can check that out over at triggerpointresearch.com and find out more information on how we actually manage money here at Horowitz & Company. And what we do is we have a variety of strategies. Just go on to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and you can click the little button that shows you, hey, what's going on with this strategy, the trading strategy, and gives you a whole tutorial of about 13 minutes. You can run through that, find out what we're doing, check that out, as well as our global strategies. Great stuff available for you. So I wanted you to know all that before we kind of segued into our discussion with Tim Knight. And you know, a while back we had him on. It's been a really long time. Tim Knight is with us today from The Slope of Hope, a great blog and website. Also author of Charting Your Way to Profit and founder of Profit Charts and Profit Financial, now owned by TD Ameritrade. Hey, Tim, man, it's got to be over a year, right?
Yeah, I didn't check. It has definitely been at least a year, maybe two.
Lots of things have changed over that time period. One of the things is that the new paradigm is that the markets are not allowed to go down anymore.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so that's the new rule. Yeah, it's outlawed. And now all you do is, you know, as we talked about here and there, it's, you know, every 2 or 3 point tick down on the S&P is the idea that, oh, that's a crash, we need to buy it. Let's talk a little bit about, I know you do a lot of charting work and use a variety of different, we'll call it indicators and metrics and things of that nature. You've been doing this a very long time. What is kind of going on right now, in your opinion, in terms of the insatiable appetite to bid this market up?
Well, the past 4 years have been, you know, pretty much a nightmare for bearish types like yours truly. You know, and it's interesting too, because if we look back to the psychology at the end of 2008, the beginning of 2009, and people were sort of reflecting on what had happened with the financial crisis and how deeply things had fallen, you know, people are sort of get universally very wise, and they scratch their chins and say, well, now it's, you know, I've learned my lesson. Now I can see so clearly how silly we were. And this has gone on in human history, you know, for thousands of years. People just sort of, in the depths of whatever panic or whatever you might happen, people get very, very insightful and introspective. And at the time, my view was that, you know, sure, we would have a bounce, but that after a certain bounce, we would sort of, you know, kind of resume the bear market. And of course, the thing that certainly I didn't count on was the willingness of the government to basically write a, you know, $16 trillion check to prop things up, and it has thus far worked magnificently. And it's interesting too, because, you know, I've read some bloggers describe this as like the world's most hated rally, because it seemed for a while that things were generally going up and no one could believe it. And finally, after all this ascent, something just kind of clicked in 2013, and suddenly the public's finally jumping on board and everyone sort of buys into it and says, this really is working. And so there's this kind of euphoric rush returning that the skepticism seems to be kind of completely dismissed. One look at a VIX graph will show you that. And the acronym I read this morning was TINA, There Is No Alternative. Mm-hmm. The notion being that, and you know, the postulate of, you know, quote, cash on the sidelines has been offered up in every bull market since, you know, Andrew Jackson was the president. And that's what's going on now, that, well, naturally, in the market, yeah, sure, it's gone up hundreds of percent, but it's just going to keep going higher because, you know, you've got this monstrous bond bubble that's going to deflate right into equities. So that'll just keep pushing things higher.
You know, what's really fascinating, though, is you mentioned that people get introspective when they do things foolish. And what happens is that they say, you know, we're not going to do that again, right? You know, we're not going to make that same mistake again. But it actually, there's two sides of that. The first side is, or the side that you mentioned, is that when they kind of just threw the baby out with the bathwater And, you know, we saw them just kind of getting rid of stocks, which some of them you have to believe that there was some realistic chance of the stock going bankrupt, right? I mean, you know, there was definitely some things going on there. And without that helping hand of Uncle Sam, there would have been a lot more. Now, the other side of that is, hey, how could I have been so stupid to believe that this housing boom was going to last forever and no money down and no credit checks and 110% mortgages and all that was going to last? And how could I have been sucked into that? And the second part of that would be, hey, wait a minute, how would I, you know, back to 2000, how did I believe that we could buy stocks at multiples that were incalculable because there was no earnings? Right. And then so you got both sides of that, but I think that at the height of each, the depth of the despair and the height of the euphoria, it's very hard to see what's going on.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's funny because around March 2009, February 2009, something like that, I heard, I don't know what role the man had, but he was, you know, from an investment bank or is an analyst or something. And he was saying that, you know, anybody who's not buying stocks right now is going to be kicking themselves later. And, you know, perma-bear / cynic that I am, you know, I was thinking of, you know, oh, yeah, buddy. And, you know, he was exactly right. Because the fact is that, to your point earlier, even if you had, you know, take any amount of money, just say $100,000, say, all right, I'm going to put $5,000 into 20 completely randomly selected stocks that have been getting the crap kicked out of them, and maybe some will go bankrupt, and maybe some won't. And the fact is that even if one or two of them went out of business, you would probably be looking at multi-100% gains at this point.
Right.
Because, you know, to your point earlier, the euphoria and the despair, and let's face it, you know, in our lifetimes, this was an extraordinary shift. It was way too high and way too low. And the uncertainty that none of us can comprehend now is, well, no one really believes that this debt will ever be repaid, and so what's going to happen? How will the Fed possibly unwind its position? You know, how? Because, you know, Ben Bernanke, you can find interviews of him stating, "I will not monetize the debt." That's all he does, is monetize the debt. The Fed is the largest buyer of bonds, right, in this market, and it's like the right hand is paying the left hand, and it's sort of this, and the vast majority of the American public has no idea what's going on. And so, but those who are like you and me, who kind of study this, it's like, how is this going to, what's the denouement of this? How is this all going to complete itself? Where is this heading? And I think the perception is, oh, screw that. Things are great now. Just, you know, the music's playing.
Yeah.
Keep going.
Right. Yeah, I'm feeling good right now. I'm feeling good. Give me another drink. You know,
right.
And that's, you know, but here's what's interesting, that what would have been I don't want to say criminal, but just unthought of, unthinkable, of the amount of money that we are actually in debt for.
Right.
And the amount of interaction and proactive stance that the Fed has taken. We've seen this not only here, though, but it's kind of like an epidemic that's kind of spread around the world. There are some countries that have tried to tamp it down and said, you know what, we're going to watch the inflation, we're going to watch that because of all this is – really doing some damage to our markets. But it's amazing, first of all, that we have no inflation, even though I always say this, even though everything costs us a lot more. So there's no inflation officially, so they can keep on doing what they do. And the bigger question is, I think, why is there no inflation if we just pumped all this money into the economy and devalued the dollar? And why? Some of it is because we had to fill a hole, right? We had to fill a gigantic gaping hole of like a meteor that crashed into it. The second thing is, around the world are doing the same thing too.
Right.
So we're all on the same level, generally speaking. It's not like, we have this inflation problem because, you know, everybody's doing the same thing. And, you know, my favorite, probably of all time, is the Japanese, who have clearly stated that they are not intervening in the yen.
Yeah.
Right. It's market forces, right? So
right.
So where do we go from here? I mean, you know, let's kind of take off the I'm a bear, I'm a bull. Let's kind of just kind of like freshen up a look at this for a second. Is it in the cards that we can continue seeing, the continuation of a buy the dip, which we'll call it 4 or 5 weeks old? I mean, it looked pretty ugly before that, right? I mean, the end of the year.
Well, yeah. No, if you look at the past It's sort of curious because if you look from, you know, March 2009 to present, and you and I are talking here in February 2013, if you look at that 4-year period, the swings are getting more and more and more muted, both to the downside and the upside. And so on my blog I've diagrammed this, sort of showing where the QE's kicked in. And, you know, one had this incredible explosive force, two had a pretty powerful force, three was kind of not much, and four, when it was announced, actually the market went up for like literally like 7 trading hours and then started falling. And so each one of these new bazookas that the Fed fires is less and less effective. Now, on a nominal basis, as we head up to, like, you know, things like Dow 14,000, it seems like, oh, things are still on fire. If you look at the chart, it's really, especially when you look at like the Dow or the S&P, it's really struggling. Yes, there are some things like the small caps which continue to like lurch to like new lifetime highs, but the actual magnitude of the movement is getting more and more muted. And the really tricky thing with this whole bit is that even in the midst of the whole housing and credit boom, it was very easy for just a completely average person who doesn't really do this for a living to understand what was going on. It's sort of like, all right, banks are handing out lots of money at good rates, and homeowners and speculators are able to buy up real estate and use that asset to buy other things, and that's helping the economy in general. So the notion of like easy money leading to real estate going up in value and thus the wealth effect, you can explain that in about a paragraph to just about any guy you'd walk up to in a bar. I mean, it's not that complicated. What's going on now, you know, sovereign debt and monetization of debt and the bond purchases and the Forex markets. I mean, I have done nothing but study the financial markets for the past 25 years. I've written a blog for 8 years. I talk to a lot of really, really smart people. I have only the faintest, wispiest grasp of sort of what's happening, and God help me to figure out what's going to happen next. So I'm probably in like a 99.8th percentile in terms of like how well read I am on this, and I don't know what the hell is going on.
I agree.
So yeah, that's scary.
I agree. I mean, it's kind of like the feeling of the markets recently, most recently, is like, what is really going on behind the back of the curtain, you know, that's really driving some of this? Because, you know, even when we see good news, okay, fine, things move up, you know, bad news, things move up. And, you know, it's that kind of David Tepper mentality. We saw recently wholesale inventories drop. And when you look at that, you can make a statement about it. You can say, well, it's good. Wholesale inventory is dropping. That means that the manufacturers are going to have to replenish, and that's going to be good a couple of quarters down the road. And that means also retail is selling and they're manufacturing, and that's kind of a good thing because you want to see inventories kind of lean a bit, right? On the other hand, you can say, well, inventory is dropping is a negative to GDP. So, you know, that's a negative. But on the other hand, you could say when they go up, it's a positive to GDP, even though it's a negative to consumers and, you know, in sales and things like that. And it's almost like we take whatever story it is and find that headline that we like, Amazon being probably the biggest example that's, you know, today.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they missed earnings last time. They missed earnings this time. Revenues were good, but everybody was focusing on the gross margins.
Yeah. No, you only have to look at how the market interprets news, either world news or business news, to kind of get a take on things. I remember so well back in, I think it was July 2006, that there was, And you know, I was in the same position I am now, which is like looking for shorts, looking for bearish opportunities. And there was like, you remember the bombing in the London subway system.
Mm-hmm.
And on the Globex, you know, the Dow fell 100 and so forth. The next day, the market just roared higher. And it's like, all right, you know, at this point, nuclear conflict would send the market up because of like manufacturing purchases. You know, it was just, you couldn't break anything. No matter what news came out, the market just kept going higher. And that's kind of what's going on right now, because the dips that we are getting have gotten tinier and tinier and tinier and very short-lived. And it's literally gotten to the point now where, you know, drops in the market, you got to measure them in hours instead of months. They're just, it's just a little wisp, and then it's like gone. And what's happening before our eyes is that there are fewer and fewer bears. They're just giving up. I mean, they're just given up. And I'm going to be like the last man standing. I'll have $4.77 to invest at the time. It does happen. But I'll be the last guy around who actually thinks there's such thing as a good short position anymore.
Well, that's a good question because, you know, it's actually I'll give you an example. We looked at Yum Brands, okay, the other day. And we looked at the fundamentals, and the company's coming saying they're going to have a really rough year, and we knew some of that, and the whole chicken issue in China has been an issue, and we kind of looked at the chart and said, okay, that's interesting. It dropped off right after earnings pretty sharply, which I guess kind of expected on what the news that they had provided. And then it started rising a little bit, It came right into one of our key resistance areas, which would be formerly support, high volume. And we said, okay, you know, this is kind of stopping right there, and it's starting to tick down from there. We're going to pick up a small short position in that. And lo and behold, a day later, the stock is up like 2.5%. All right, not a big deal. You know, it's kind of like, you know, flushing out a little bit, getting that kind of range going. It's not like a 20% move. It's, you know, but you have to wonder, wait a minute. How come I'm seeing all of these stocks that come out with negative earnings, or not negative, but bad earnings, poor earnings, expectations? They drop immediately, and then they're just driven right back up. FedEx, same thing.
I'll just say, it's funny you should mention that, because Yum is actually a short I covered today, and it was based, as you were laying it out, my rationale was very, very close to yours, although it was a little more charty, because, you know, they had gapped way down, and there was this very clean gap, and I had no position at the time, but I'm thinking, you know what, if we get anywhere close to that gap, I'm shorting it, because this is a beautiful chart. You've got this long-term broken trend line, and you've got this gap, and hurrah.
Yep.
I went in, and it just kept going up. It closed the gap, it just kept going. It's like, and finally today, I cried uncle and covered it at a loss. But that, you know, it's just like, damn, what did it take?
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, I'm still short, you know, we're still short Yum, and there is a small range that will hold it. From what we do in terms of how we look at the support levels and all that, there's some, in my opinion, there's some, it closed right on its high volume node from a previous about 50 or 60 day period. And but I agree, though, that it was strangely strong considering all the news that was out, you know, and you see the same thing. You know, Nike's an interesting one. I mean, I can name a variety of these, but you know what I always call these? I call these the loved stocks. It doesn't matter what happens, because there are those players that have core positions in them, and they believe that longer term it's going to be okay. And what they do, it doesn't matter what's happening, right? And it doesn't matter what the company says. By the way, how many companies have come out with downward guidance and the stock still goes up because people just don't believe it?
Right. Yeah, I don't even, I don't think I've touched Nike in years. They're just some stocks that just aren't even worth touching for me.
Right.
They're just impossible to go down. And the really freaky thing, if you look at charts for the long term, is looking at things like you know, the rental car companies like Delta Thrifty Group, DTG, things like this. And, you know, they went from like 1 to 54. And it's like, you know, what exactly is the difference between people renting cars in airports in 2008 and right now? I mean, did they discover gold underneath every Thrifty booth in every airport in America? I don't get it, you know, because you see these stocks that have gone up, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of percent, and it's just astonishing that you look at these kinds of gains for companies that really aren't any different than they were a few years ago.
Well, the only difference, obviously, is that people are traveling more. I mean, you look at the price lines, the Expedias, you know, you look at those kind of things. We happen on CAR, C-A-R,
right.
And I'll tell you something. It would been also, if I was to think through this in an environment not looking at the chart and not looking at the fundamentals, okay, just to kind of think conceptually about it, I'd be, I'm not buying that. Right. That doesn't make any sense. You know, I mean, kind of people
later.
You know, but we bought it, and it's up huge.
Right. But, you know, true enough, they may be traveling more. They're not traveling 50 times as much, so they may be traveling 20% more. But, you know, that's all I'm saying is that you can find lots of stocks that went from a buck to 50 bucks, and it's just jaw-dropping.
So,
and those are the kinds of trades on which fortunes are made. That's amazing to me.
So let's talk about some of the characteristics of a position that you would look to short in terms of some of the work that you do and on charting and on your analysis, so that we can kind of see what the setup is. Let's also admit, and you know, this is not hopefully going to shock anybody that's listening, there will be a time that the markets will correct. Okay, I don't know if that's tomorrow or next week, or it is starting to happen already, which we are starting to see a lot more chop all of a sudden. But yet, at the same time, you know, there will be a time. We've seen a lot of stocks drop very significantly after earnings. And, you know, you look at NHLF, which happened there, the Herbalife. You look at, you know, Nu Skin. You look at, I mean, there's a whole host of things. Look at what happened to Green Mountain, the ups and the downs. So give me a kind of a, talk me through a setup that you would look for in a stock that you would consider shorting.
Sure. Well, I mean, my style is a little peculiar because I look at a lot of charts every day, literally oftentimes like 1,000 charts a day. I can look at them really, really fast. And
wow.
I've been doing this so long that I'm a sort of an idiot savant when it comes to charts. So I can just buzz through them and I organize them and so forth. And I also, usually trade a rather large number of positions. I mean, there was a time that I would be managing, you know, like way over 100 positions. Now I'm, you know, in quotes, kind of conservative and have maybe like, you know, 60 or 70 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I tend to have lots and lots of teeny little positions. And on occasion, when I feel a little more confident, which is not the case now, I'll put on some very general big ETF positions.
Mm-hmm.
And so in doing so, what I'm looking for is just kind of old school patterns and very, very simple charts. Because you mentioned at the beginning of the show about indicators and such. I don't think there's a single indicator I use. I basically use my eyeballs and some straight lines here and there. So I'm looking for trend lines, support and resistance. On occasion, if they work well with the chart, Fibonacci fan lines and retracement. And so, for instance, you mentioned Herbalife earlier. Herbalife just happens to have one of the prettiest diamond patterns I've ever seen in my life. And at around 45, I was really touting it on the blog as a beautiful short opportunity. And the whole Icon Agman thing happened and so forth, and there's a lot of ups and downs with that. And, you know, in the back of my mind, when I hear, you know, this obviously profoundly successful investor like Carl Icahn saying the stock's going 70, I get a little worried.
Mm-hmm.
But in my head, it's like, well, there's still the diamonds, and diamonds my friends. So in that instance, it turned out to be a really, really good trade, and it headed down into, like, the upper 20s. And if you were to ask me, you know, 2 years from now, do you think it's going to be a $10 stock or $70 stock? I'm probably going to choose 10 because it's just a sensational pattern. But in any of my trading, what I'm focused on is when I can declare myself wrong based upon whatever the basis of the trade was. So going back to Yum, if the basis was a certain gap, it's like, all right, when the gap's closed and it just keeps going higher, it ain't working, so I'll get out. In the case of Herbalife, you know, at first it'll be the diamond pattern. As it moves into a profitable position, there might be other criteria, like a descending channel, or that I'll use as the basis of, like, this doesn't work anymore. And so my desire is to get in with a risk of 2, 3, maybe 4%, at which time I'll decide that the rationale for this trade isn't working anymore, therefore I'm going to get out. Now, I'm way more interested in the risk management through all of this than anything else. So what I want to see as a admitted permabear is the market's obviously going to go up. If I can at least be suffering less than the market's going up, I'm a happy guy. Taking today, for example, the market today looking at, and I use basically as the basis for my what the market is doing, Spiders, IWM, and the cubes. Add them up, divide them by three. That's, to me, that's the market.
Mm-hmm.
And so today, the market was up something like 0.75%. I was down something like 0.34%.
Mm-hmm.
It's nothing to shout about when you're down, but I'll take it. You know, if I can lose less than the market gained, that's dandy. Because my converse hope is that on, you know, the 2 days out of the year the market actually does drop, if I can be up more than the market is down, then I'm a happy camper. Because I want, that's my version of beating the market. I want my shirts to be well chosen enough that they buck up and don't rise too nastily when the market's strong, and they can take a nice tumble when the market actually does show signs of weakness. And so with this many positions, I'm always watching those two figures. Like, what's the market doing? What am I doing? And how is that, you know, that's kind of this beast that I've created. Like, how does it correlate?
So do you have any longs in the portfolio at all?
It's a funny thing. The short answer is no. The longer answer is there are actually plenty of charts that I like on the long side, and on my blog, and also I do a little kind of webcast each day. I've been not shy at all about talking about stocks that I love on the long side.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't the least bit surprised that LinkedIn shot higher today. You know, LinkedIn has been, you know, kind of a freak in terms of social networking because it hasn't gotten battered. I mean, down when Facebook was getting, you know, beaten down in the teens, LinkedIn just sort of put its hands on its hips and just kept striding along. So it's done consistently well. And based on the pattern today, the fact that it went up like 22% doesn't surprise me in the least. You know, Groupon. I thought Groupon was a total joke as it was grinding down to like 250 or something. But over the past few months, it's been forming a beautiful base. And mm-hmm. It's like at 5-something now. If you told me in a month it'd be an $8 stock, I wouldn't be surprised at all. It's a gorgeous-looking basing position. And so there are literally 3 or 4 dozen charts I could show you that I think are terrific looking long. But as far as my own trading right now, given where the market's at in general, I have no interest in buying anything in spite of that.
Yeah, I mean, there is clearly a – you could see some of the stocks out there that have just, you know, overshot a reasonable level considering the earnings – you know, situation, considering the headwinds, considering everything that, you know, we've had over the last couple of days some just beautiful positions. I mean, Shutterfly was up 22% yesterday or the day before, yep, a couple of days ago. This week also Fleetcore was up 12%. You know, we had another one up 6%. You know, and not on really great days, but, you know, some of the earnings news was very interesting with them. But also, you still have to say, okay, you know, wait a minute. Why are these stocks moving up this much, considering the earnings beat or miss? When you see a stock, you know, like Riverbed, they miss and they're down 20%. And you see, you know, this whole, it's almost like there's euphoria on both sides, right? You know, where they're either selling the crap out of something or they're buying the crap, and then you'll know a couple of days later they're going to start pulling it in a little bit,
yeah,
or either side. So what do you make of the fact that the small caps are leading here? They were really, you know, kind of for a while, you know, seeing a lot of volatility on the ups and downs last year, and then they just kind of became this real leader. I mean, does that say something about the markets, or is it more of that it can be pushed around a little bit more? It's a thinner trade. Is it the futures that are doing it? What's your take?
Yeah, it's funny because, I mean, to take two extremes, and if you look at a chart of the, say, S&P 100, the OEX, the OEX is nowhere near its lifetime highs, and even though it broke above this long descending trend line, it's still very, very weak. On the other hand, if you look at the Russell, $RUT, it is at what I call a 15-billion-year high. You know, it's never been this high in the history of the universe.
Right.
And that's incredible. It's as if the financial crisis never happened. And I'm not sure what stocks are most to credit for that. There's certainly plenty of very handsome-looking long positions, and, you know, not a few of them are small caps. But that's why, you know, it's kind of a quagmire for me, because there are really strong arguments to be made on either side right now. And the thing is that the psychology, I think, that's really changed is that people's basis for fear seems to be getting blown away. So, for example, if you look at August 2011, when the whole debt crisis thing was happening, the whole debt ceiling thing was happening, and the market, you know, you were talking about the Russell, it lost about 25%
right
of its value,
yep,
in the course of 2 or 3 weeks. That's going to scare the bejesus out of people.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened, and so, you know, what's chapter two of that? Well, we have this whole thing happened in December of last year, and everyone got kind of scared, but not really. And then out of the blue, everything gets solved and things just skyrocket, you know, on the past couple of days of the year, and it really hasn't looked back since then. And then the latest, of course, was the whole debt ceiling thing, and that seemed to have gotten solved in about 27 minutes. And so each time one of these crises comes along, it's sort of like things have a half-life. And the nasty memories of August 2011 are completely forgotten. And a small version of that was experienced in December 2012, and an even tiny version of that happened just a few weeks ago. And now we've got the sequestration thing coming up. I don't think people are going to give it one minute of thought.
No,
and
I agree.
The thing is that, as you said earlier, at some point, and I don't even call them a correction because that's such a gentle term for it. At some point, a bear market will take hold again, and it's going to be completely unexpected because no one expects anything to ever fall again.
Yeah.
And so, you know, let's just pretend, and I'm not postulating this at all, but let's just pretend that the end of February comes along and John Boehner actually finds a spine somewhere and makes a completely obscene gesture on national television and said, we're getting serious about spending cuts and Obama eat me, and, you know, and then the market falls 500 points the next day. No one's going to expect that because the VIX is at 12.
Right.
And no one's going to expect it because Boehner has completely caved in if Obama, like, looks at him cockeyed. And yep. So crisis after crisis of the government has gotten resolved very, very swiftly, and I'm sure people aren't even thinking about the Social Sequester thing. And so, again, I'm not saying that, well, this time it's really going to fall. I don't know. But honestly, at some point, the $16 trillion in debt and climbing and the fact that things are so completely papered over right now, the chickens are going to come home with roost at some point. It may be the year 2037. It might be this Monday. I don't know.
Right, right, right.
All I do know is that, as God is my witness, you know, any shorts that I see that are vulnerable looking, I'm going to be in them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the other thing that has to be said is that, you know, valuation does matter. And there's a lot of discussion about, hey, you know, PEs and all that, which I discount PEs because they're just a single fundamental view that doesn't compare anything to anything, right? So, right. You know, you got this PE issue, but when you look at forward PEs, then of course what analysts are projecting, one of the things that has happened over this last quarter was that analysts really brought down estimates very substantially just into the quarter, and lo and behold, a lot of companies beat the estimate. Now, if you look back, though, and you look at historical earnings trends, and you looked at, you know, last year, the quarter over quarter and all that, you know, companies, there are some companies, but generally speaking, that there's not that big of a difference in growth in earnings. And the revenue situation is lower. And in fact, analysts are estimating that revenues will be starting to decline over the next, you know, from this quarter forward. So when you look at that, you have to think to yourself, wait a minute, let me get this straight. Stocks are X amount higher than they were a year ago, the same quarter a year ago, but yet we haven't seen that much of a dramatic increase in earnings, and earnings are really the whole deal here. So there's something to be said about also looking at the fundamentals and questioning when do fundamentals matter. Sometimes that they don't, because there's, you know, the idea that PEs will be expanded and you know with sentiment. But you know, I saw a great piece the other day, by the way, from Sentiment Trader. And I don't know if you saw this, but they looked at the level of bull versus bear sentiment in markets over, I don't even know how long it was. It was, you know, last few years. And usually when you get to that peak level, obviously when sentiment is just, you know, so euphoric and everything's happy and buying and all that, and everybody's bullish, the newsletters are bullish, and you can't find anybody on TV, you know, talking about anything. And they kind of keep on rolling out Jeremy Siegel, who, by the way, misses every correction. But because he says that in the future it's going to be higher, which, you know, he'll be right, I guess, long term. Yeah. But, you know, he keeps on saying that, I didn't think that was going to happen. But all we need is a Jeremy Siegel, you know, well, stocks are going to be higher, you know, so it's all we need to have. So now the thing is that when you look at this, I kind of, you know, come back to looking at that Sentiment Trader chart, which was, I mean, pinned to the top. Mm-hmm. Higher than it's been, I think, ever, they said. They never saw such a bullish reading up there, which on one hand is good, by the way. You know, I mean, for longs, I mean, that's a bullish indicator and all that. The other hand, it's a little bit of a contrarian indicator, you know, if it stays there for a while, because then there's kind of buyer's exhaustion after a while. I mean, everybody put their money in, and everybody's kind of, you know, and then where's the rest of the money come from to fund this whole buying spree?
Yeah, no, it's... It's discomforting to me, you know, because sentiment, from time to time, I'll look at sentiment and eventually it kind of looks like an EKG to me, and it's not that profoundly helpful, added to which I'm naturally kind of drawn toward bearish publications, and there have been over the past 4 years many, many instances that, you know, you were absolutely sure the market would go no higher than this, and it just kept going higher. And so over the course of time, it doesn't rattle me that much to see sentiment, especially, you know, pegged up to the upside. To the downside, it probably is a better buy signal.
Yeah, I agree with that. I totally agree with that, by the way. Much better.
Right. And it is, you know, it's funny too, because from a kind of a social perspective, the other buy signals that tend to be really good are, you know, look at Occupy Wall Street. When they were all over the media and it was like, looked like it was actually going to do something, that's probably a great time to buy. So I'll tell you that if in years to come you ever do see sort of like, oh my God, you know, Lloyd Blankfein better watch out because the people have their pitchforks, well, that's probably the time to buy. Because all those protestations are right. long gone. Everything's just peaches and cream right now. And added to which, to mention a blog that is well known for its bearishness and its kind of tinfoil hat wearing, and one I like to look at on a daily basis is Zero Hedge. When their service went down, you know, when they were so busy, their service went down back in the summer of 2011,
mm-hmm.
also probably a good time to buy.
Right, yeah.
Because
yeah.
when everybody and his brother is crowded into a place like that, then that's a contrarian signal. I've been sort of stunned myself that my own blog's traffic has been so steady. I would figure by now, like me and two guys wearing aluminum foil chapeaus would be the only people left bothering to go slow. But I think it's a testament to a good variety of content that is still really popular, in spite of the fact that it's no secret that it's a very bearish place.
Now, you do a great job with that, but I'll tell you something.
Well, thank you, man.
I'll tell you something that a negative or a bearish piece that I write gets a lot more attention than a positive, you know, kind of, this is a really great stock to buy for long haul, something like that, you know, whatever. I get just a lot more hits. It's very clear about that. But I just want to mention, you did say two things in this conversation that I have not heard in a long time, and I thought they were put away somewhere in a box, and I totally forgot about them. You said Occupy Wall Street. I haven't heard of that for a long time. And the other one, that I had to actually just stop for a moment and kind of think about was John Boehner, because I haven't heard from him either in a long time.
Exactly. I mean, you would, they have those little press conferences, and it's getting kind of comic because they'll get on and they'll put on a good show about, you know, damn it, we're drawing a line right here. The line's drawn with a very faint pencil, and an eraser is handed over to the president.
Yep.
I mean, it's just, you know, it's astonishing because he, again, puts on a brave face and so forth, but I've been stunned. And I'm not, this isn't a political show, and I'm certainly not proselytizing for either side, but I'm just kind of amazed that it's like, aren't you supposed to kind of like, I don't know, take a stand or something?
Yep.
I mean, gracious, you know, just given within 12 seconds.
Yep.
So,
well, I have a theory
day.
On this. I have a theory.
Yeah. Okay.
It's very simple. They all have portfolios.
Right.
That's it. Stop right there and you say, okay, that's an explanation. I get that. Because I was thinking about this for a while. I was thinking about this. I'm thinking, how is it that they wanted last time a $300 billion cut to spending, and that kind of disappeared within a couple of hours, and they gave in? Why? Because futures were about to open, and they said, you know what, the hell with it. I don't want my portfolio going down. We'll deal with it another day.
Right.
So anyway.
That is the thing, because the fact is that, you know, you will hear on occasion that the reason the market's going to go up is because the Fed's in control and they don't want the market to go down. It's like, huh, that's interesting. I wonder if they just discovered this power since 2008. You know, because there are times when it may seem hard to believe, but that the forces of the markets actually are bigger than the Fed.
Yep.
And they're bigger than John Boehner. And, you know, the thing is that when those forces come back, and again, I don't know if we'll observe this tomorrow, Martian colony, it'll take that long, but when those forces come back, it's going to make 2008 look like a joke, because the magnitude of the forces are so much bigger. I mean, you know, Ma and Pa Kettle having a home equity line of credit, BFD. It's nothing compared to the situation the government's
in. Well, because we shifted. You know, now no longer, you know, the big problem we had was that people were borrowing from their houses and borrowing from their equity lines, and they were using that to buy all sorts of things, right? And then what happened was when prices went down and all that, that just collapsed and just caused a whole, you know, just a domino effect, right? Take that, put that aside for a second. Now, the countries around the world are borrowing home equity loans, okay? Mm-hmm. And they're tapping themselves out. Now the question you have is, it's very simple. Okay, when the housing crisis fails and all this can happen and you have the banking situation, all this, who bails them out? Well, governments, right? Okay, well, when the governments have a problem, and who's going to bail them out? We only have God, man. That's all we got left.
Right.
That's
exactly.
That's all we got. So, you know?
Yeah. No, too true. And the thing is that there, you know, plenty of very smart people that I listen to have all kinds of different opinions. You know, some might say it's going to be 100,000 on the Dow, but bread will be $100 a slice, or gold's going to 5,000 ounce. Because I'm sure there's a lot of gold bugs that are a little ticked off that things have been kind of stalled for the past couple of years. It doesn't make any sense. You know, so there's this, all these like macro narratives that haven't panned out, but I'm sure any of those parties you go to will just basically say, yet, you know, just you wait. You know, just you wait until, you know, the U.S. dollar's worth toilet paper, or gold is $10,000 an ounce, or God knows what. I actually don't buy in, I neither buy into nor dismiss any of them, because I think one of those outcomes will take place. I just don't know which one, and I don't think anybody is
on. You can't hang your hat on it. I hear you. Tim Knight from theslopeofhope.com. Make sure to visit his site. We'll have all the information on the show notes for this podcast. Also, the author of Chart Your Way to Profits. Great stuff. He's got great things on his site, great resources, and is very entertaining as well. So, Tim, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
It's been a kick. Thanks a bunch.
Thanks. Well, clearly a perma bear, as he said it. You know, anybody that has a portfolio that's all shorts, I mean, what else can you describe him as, right? So we do know that markets do correct. They do turn around. The KRI indicator, as I mentioned earlier, which we're going to have on the site, is in a it's in a neutral position. We call that markets in equilibrium, which means that neither side right now has the edge. Clearly, over the last week and a half or so, there was some downside pressure building up in the markets, you know, and there was some economics that kind of helped and hurt, and earnings that helped and hurt. But it's time for a little bit of a breather, I think, a consolidation range, even though we did see record inflows into equity funds, which means that the retail investor is kind of hopping in at the towards the top here. Now, that could last a while. The euphoria can go on for a while. The fund flows, because interest rates are so low around the world, and where else are you going to put your money, is the common saying these days. You know, where else am I going to put my money? And it seems to stocks are the play. Well, that is either a really great thing that people are have a lot of confidence in the markets right now, or a really worrisome situation that, well, here we go again. Retail's getting in on the back end of everything. They held off. They had their money in the sidelines and cash and bonds, and now they're rolling out. What next? A lot of the players that you listen to will talk about how we're going to see this great rotation from bonds to stocks. That may happen, but it'll only happen if two things. Number one, the economy improves, and number two, the Fed decides to take their foot off the gas pedal, because they are holding down bond yields significantly. So take what you want out of that, and I hope you have a prosperous, enjoyable week. And until next week, hope you listen to DH Unplugged, which we'll have on Wednesday, available for you over on iTunes. And please give us a review on iTunes. I read every single one of them. So I appreciate your time. I appreciate you listening. And I want to tell you, thanks a lot for joining me. See you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.